Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more of America This Week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. You're listening to America This Week.
This is Tim Reedy with Father Matt Malone of America This Week on the Catholic Channel, and we are joined today, the day before St. Patrick's Day, by the author and scholar Peter Quinn. Now, Peter, we were just talking a bit about, the Irish-American experience and specifically how it was shaped by the famine. One of the interesting things as we look to the 100th anniversary of the Easter Rising was kind of the disconnect between the people who were involved in that movement, who were mostly middle class, as you write about it in a recent essay, versus the people who left were mostly, as we say, you know, people who were people of the land and didn't have much connections necessarily with those political movements.
They did and they didn't. I mean, there was always an emotional attachment to what had happened in Ireland and an emotional memory of why they were in America. But the rebellion wouldn't have happened without America. And it was John Devoy, who had been a Fenian arrested in 1867 and spent time in jail and was exiled to the United States. And he was this incredible, he was referred to as the Lenin of the Irish Revolution. Right. When the World War I broke out, German intelligence took two files, one for a guy named Lenin and the other for John Devoy, in ways to disrupt the British war effort. And the Clan na Gael in America was incredibly important to the revolution in Ireland. Every Irish, Kay Smith, Lady Gregory, Pierce, were all in New York. And they took a lot of inspiration, you know, the idea of a republic, a democratic society where different groups could mix. That was very important to them. You see that in the Proclamation.
Right.
You know, the Proclamation, a pretty amazing document when you read it today. It begins Irish men and Irish women. Right. And then, you know, cherishing all the children of the nation equally. It's a beautiful phrase. It's like pursuit of liberty or life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Right.
And they had that ideal. You know, it was a very diverse group of people. We kind of look back at just the people in the post office, but Ireland was a boil with different movements, suffragettes, vegetarians, socialists, big socialist movement in Ireland.
And so for our listeners who may not know, what exactly is the significance of this anniversary? And you know, just quickly, what actually happened at this post office?
It was supposed to be the Irish Republican Brotherhood recognized right away World War I was the big opening, if it was going to be. The British would be preoccupied. The old, you know, Britain's problems are Ireland's opportunity. Well, this was a pretty big problem. So they began to plot when they would have this rising. And they talked to Devoy in New York, and he talked to the Germans. They were going to bring guns in. And there was a group called the Irish Volunteers, which were formed in reaction to the Ulster Volunteers. Mm-hmm. You know, they said absolute no home. They're still... Northern Ireland is the last refuge of the Ulster Volunteers. So the Irish Volunteers were set up in reaction to them, and there was a small group inside the Irish Volunteers who was going to take them over and use them for the revolution. And the plot was to do it on Easter Sunday. They would give this order to mobilize. And the head of the Irish Volunteers, who wasn't in on this, Ian McNeil, countermanded the order. And then they countermanded his order. So a national uprising wound up just being a rising in Dublin.
Right.
And they seized this post office as a sign of the British rule in Ireland, and Dublin Castle tried to seize Dublin Castle and set up, and they fought a really pitched battle. The center of Dublin was destroyed. The British put in gunboats. They weren't fooling around.
Right.
And they held it for a week, which is a pretty amazing thing.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
And
the story is, some people say it's not true. You know, when they were taken out of the post office, they were spit on.
Right.
Because people said, this is ridiculous. You destroy the city for the stupid. And then the British government proceeded to shoot all of them one by one.
Because a lot of the Irish weren't Republicans at the time.
No, the majority of Irish were not Republicans.
Yeah.
But the hardcore Pierce, Connolly, they really believed, you know, if they made this stand, it would reverberate in the deepest part of Irish people and with their history.
Yeah.
And if they didn't come around immediately, they would.
Right.
And the revolutionaries were right. They had this idea, Pierce had it, and it can get a little... extreme, the blood sacrifice, which is one of the reasons they wanted Easter,
right.
You know, associated with the rising of Christ and Good Friday. And if you ever see The Plow and Stars by Sean O'Casey, he has a character outside the barroom who's Pierce. He sounds, you know, like a bloodthirsty maniac outside the bar.
And it was really the British reaction, you know, that I mean, they executed all of these folks, right. except De Valera, who was right. who's kind of remotely associated with it, more remotely associated.
He was
with
right
it.
There fighting.
Yeah.
Yeah, Boland's Mill.
Oh, he was in the middle of it.
Oh, yeah.
And they didn't execute him because he was an American
well,
citizen?
Well, that's what they say. And yeah. one, other people say they didn't shoot him because they realized of the terrible publicity effect this was having. Yeah. It was having the exact opposite. And they were very careful about American opinion.
Right.
You know, Britain was doing everything it could to bring America in the war.
Right.
And the last thing they needed to do was incite Irish America more than it was already incited.
So they got really tough and executed these folks, and then that had a kind of transformative effect
right.
on
well,
Irish
then they,
opinion.
They interned a couple of thousand people,
right.
put Ireland under martial law, and then they had the first, when the war ended, they had the first post-war election, 1918.
Yeah.
And this party, Sinn Féin, just swept the board. They won the majority of the vote in Ulster, the nine counties of Ulster, by one seat. And they said, we're not going to Parliament. We're not going to go. We're not a Home Rule party. We're an independence party.
Right.
And we're going to set up an Irish government in Dublin, in the Doyle, in the old Irish Parliament.
Right.
And the British said, no way. So this is 1919, and then they start arresting members of the Doyle, and then the IRA picks up the countryside. The guerrilla war begins, and Michael Collins comes in.
Right.
And it turns into a real guerrilla war, the first guerrilla war of the 20th century. And Collins kind of realizes the heavier the British hand gets, the more recruits you get.
Right.
They come in, the black and tans, which is no auxiliary. Instead of sending in regular troops, these guys wore, they wore khaki pants and black jackets. If you know what the Freikorps were in Eastern Europe
right.
at the end of the First World War, this was like the English version. Demobilized soldiers you employed to hold on to this territory.
Right.
And in the long run, they were a catastrophe.
Hmm.
And then you had people like Terence McSweeney, the mayor of Cork, who went on a hunger strike, died on a hunger strike. And all these things, there was so much Irish history that it resonated with, so much resentment, that it's in 1914 it seemed John Redmond and the Home Rule Party were going to get Home Rule. And then by 1922, that's just blown off the table.
Right, right. There is a, today we still have the memory of this event, and we still have the consequences of it, right? I mean,
yes.
The two main political parties are
right.
descendants of the two
right.
of the factions from
yes,
the Irish
right.
Civil War, right? And they're now locked in
maybe
struggle
formula.
To figure out
right.
how to govern this country.
Yeah.
What is this event mean in the memory of the Irish people, even those in the diaspora?
Well, I was saying before about the Irish coming to America and asserting their identity. This fact of this felt identity they had and being part of an empire where they were, I think my grandparents' happiest moment was when they renounced British citizenship.
Yeah.
And that assertion of identity that they weren't, the language had largely gone away, but the identity hadn't. It had survived. And this was an assertion that we are our own people, we have our own history, we have the right to determine our own destiny. And it was that, and I think for Irish in America, it was important, they came from a place that wasn't a country.
Right.
It was a province of Britain. And I think it was a great matter of pride that, they felt they were another country, but they never had another country. And they carried British passports. And for a lot of Irish Americans, including my own family, I think it ended with that. They didn't kind of get the Civil War in America.
Right.
They've been here a generation. It was like, what are you fighting about?
Right. Right.
And the issue at the time, Collins, when he signed the treaty, said, well, we're signing away these six counties, but guess what? The war's going to continue. And the real sticking point was the oath to the king. That if you wanted to sit in the Doyle, you had to take the oath of loyalty. They said they wouldn't take that. That's when they walked out of the Doyle and the Civil War began.
Right.
And, Civil War in many ways left scars just as bad as the Revolution.
Right.
The Free States shot 75 IRA people.
Right.
The British had executed 16.
I mean, it's extraordinary because when people think of conflict in Ireland, they think of the conflict between Protestants and Catholics.
Right.
But this is actually the greatest right. conflict of the century was
right.
between Catholics.
Right.
Right.
And,
yeah.
They thought that, and then it was a border commission. Collins and other people thought, well, this isn't permanent. This won't last. And they actually cut out six counties. Two of them were 50-50 Catholic Protestant. But that wasn't, you couldn't have a statelet of only four counties. So they had six. So they've always had this problem with Cross Maglan and Bandit Country. And, Eastern Donegal, Derry is really Catholic, heavily Catholic. And they thought those areas would be carved out, and they weren't. So, I mean, that is the great problem that's still on the boards, what finally happens with the North.
Right.
It'll be interesting if Scotland secedes. You have all these pieces beginning to float around in Europe, that all these states that seemed permanent. Scotland, Spain is coming upon.
That was the original Act of Union, Scotland and England, right?
Yeah. 1701,
How is
that was Great Britain. Now, then it'll be just Britain if Scotland leaves.
Now, it's interesting you point out recently in this essay that the 50th anniversary perhaps was not was celebrated in a very different way, perhaps because the country was very poor. And then at the 75th anniversary, it was in the midst of the trouble. So how, at the 100th anniversary, is this, the country celebrating this?
It's still being celebrated. I think the 50th was a big celebration because they were still alive, a lot of the revolution. It was a big CBS special in America, and a book and a proclamation. So, you know, everybody got around that. And the 75th, you had the troubles in the North.
Right.
And the identification with the IRA, which in 66 was not that problematic, was very problematic by the time of the 75th.
Yeah.
But now you have this peace accord in the North, and you have a different country than it was. You have a country integrated into Europe that is much sure of its identity. And I think there's going to be a rally around, you know, this, but at the same time, there'll be tension about who does the revolution belong to.
Right.
Does it belong to the, as they say disparagingly, the free status, or the Fine Gael, the blue shirts, which they had descended from a kind of quasi-fascist movement. Or does it belong to everybody? Does it belong to the left or the right? So from what I can see so far, there's a kind of union around it now. People aren't tearing each other's throats about it. Just, you know, proud of that this happened. And this small group of people defied the British Empire.
Right.
Tom Flanagan was a great Irish-American novelist. He wrote The Year of the French, one of the best historical novels. And he said when he was in England to write his second book, Tenants of Time, he was in a hotel and he looked at the Westminster and the government. And he said, I'm in the middle of London, and he's writing a book of the Fenians. He said, how could any men think they could overthrow? You know, the courage that it took to look around the city, we're going to take it on.
Right.
And I think that's the feeling of the men of 1916. What, you know, this gigantic world-girding empire and this little group of men in a post office are going to defy it and lay down their lives. In retrospect, pretty amazing thing, however you feel, whatever side you're on. You have to admire that kind of courage and determination. And again, you know, it did have an effect. It is the first uprising against empire in the 20th century.
Yeah, that's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
And
it's the first crack in these, you know, the British Empire. And then the anti-colonial movements, as after World War One and after World War Two, they sweep the globe. But this is the first one.
Mm-hmm. It was an extraordinary thing to watch. I was living in London at the time, studying at the University of London, when Queen Elizabeth II visited Ireland, one of the few places on earth she had never been.
Right.
The daughter of the last King of Ireland, right?
Well, I think she'd been to...
She'd been to Northern Ireland.
Right.
Yeah, Northern Ireland. Yeah.
Better be careful.
Yeah, exactly. But I'd never visited the Republic.
Right.
And, people, I think, on both sides said that this was really a transformative moment in their relationship.
I think it was. I mean, she went to that monument and laid a wreath at the graves of people her grandfather had executed.
Right.
And I think it was a brave thing to do.
And she had members of her own immediate family
Mountbatten
had died in this struggle. Yeah.
Who she was close to.
Right.
I thought it was a very generous, honest, sincere gesture.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it signaled that that the British had kind of were really starting to recover from their imperial hangover. Irish had actually come into their own as a nation, as a country. Yeah.
I think it's kind of ironic. Most English people at this point, I think, would like to get rid of Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
But they talked in 19th century, Winston Churchill's father, Randolph, about playing the orange card, which was the unionist votes. So they have these unionist votes in Parliament. Now they can't get rid of it. They can't. The parts of the Conservative Party would never allow it to happen.
Yeah.
I think there are large parts of the Labour Party and things with, like, you know, let's figure out how to give this to the Republic. But then there's in the Republic, there are pretty generous social benefits under the British government in the North. So then the Southern government, how do you negotiate that?
Yeah, yes, indeed.
Now, you touch a little bit about the current political situation in Ireland, but maybe you could bring our listeners up to speed because it's sort of an interesting moment.
We have this Good Friday Accord, which still holds. It can be very tense at times in the North between the there are parts of the extreme parts of the Protestant Ulster Volunteers that are not happy with it. There are extreme parts of the IRA that are still operating there now. But I think the miracle is it hasn't fallen apart. It keeps holding. And the longer it holds, the harder it becomes to overthrow. People get used to peace, you know? You can go out. Belfast, there's not barriers everywhere. If you've been at war for a couple of decades and suddenly it goes away, you say, this isn't bad. We should try a little more of this. Maybe that'll happen someday in the Mideast.
That would be nice.
Yes.
How will you spend the day tomorrow?
I will march tomorrow, and then my friends, we will go to a Mexican restaurant.
Is that so?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that because Dave Valera had a Spanish father?
Well, you know, there was an Irish brigade that fought with the Mexicans in there.
Oh, sure, of course.
San Patricios.
Yeah.
There's a monument to them in Mexico City. But then we're away from, far from the Manning crowd.
It's, yes, right. Easier to get a table.
We were in the Manning crowd long enough. Now we're old. Some of us are grandparents.
fair enough.
The days of wine and roses and Guinness are over.
Well, Peter Quinn, thanks so much for being with us to talk about this. Peter Quinn's five books are all still in print.
Yes.
Right? So
Amazon.
Be sure to check them out, particularly his trilogy.
Great St. Patrick gift for your grandmother.
Indeed, right. And there's still time.
As my agent calls it, that's pimping books, as she says.
Yeah, exactly.
Got to do it these days.
We all got to do it. So, Peter, thanks so much
for
being with us.
Thank
you, Father. Thanks for your contributions to America over these many years.
Thanks, Tim.
Okay, when we come back, we're going to be talking about Holy Week and the Triduum. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to hear the full show every week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.